Hello and welcome everyone. I'm Pete Denby, co-founder of Hyperfinity, the decision intelligence platform for retail. This is To Affinity and Beyond, our podcast about decision intelligence, data science and AI, with a particular focus on all things retail. This is the second of our two-part podcast focusing on the biggest trends we're seeing in retail and how data and AI can be used to address them. I'm joined once again by my Hyperfinity co-founder and our Chief Customer Officer, Thomas Hill. So Tom, how are you?
Yeah, I'm doing good, thanks Pete. Really well, until the point where my energy bill for December and gas and electric dropped on the floor this morning, and then I nearly vomited on myself. But I've just got over that, and I'm ready to go.
Oof, yeah, wear more jumpers, that's my advice to you. Wear more jumpers and let the children go cold.
Let the children go cold and ask my wife not to have the heating on all day, every day would be a good start, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I can empathise. Okay, good stuff. So we're going to get into the podcast now, and there's three kind of key trends we're going to cover this time round. So the first is the rise of the circular economy. We're also going to talk about what's next for department stores, and finally talk about Black Friday, and is it dark days for Black Friday? But we'll start with the rise of the circular economy. First of all, a definition. So Wikipedia, that oracle of truth, states that a circular economy is a model of production and consumption which involves sharing, leasing, reusing, repairing, refurbishing, and recycling existing materials and products for as long as possible. And according to Fast Company, fast fashion is getting faster. Clothing production doubled between 2000 and 2014, and in that same period, the number of garments purchased per capita increased by about 60%. And the dismal consequence is that fashion is consuming the earth, literally. Of course, there's one simple solution. People stop producing and buying things. But since that's not going to happen anytime soon, the next best option is a circular economy. We are, however, seeing a major movement to address what is clearly a critical issue. So retailers like the Modern Milkman are leading the way in the circular economy. Their business focuses on eliminating single-use plastics by using modern tech to create a waste-free circular supply chain. And several retailers are also offering clothing rental rather than outright ownership. So John Lewis recently started offering this. Money Supermarket actually reported that John Lewis offered dresses to rent from about £22 with a £14 fee for delivery and cleaning. And depending on the full price, this could be a more affordable way for people to have ownership, temporary ownership of clothing. Another example is Higher Street, who have high-profile partnerships with the likes of M&S at a slightly lower price point. Then, of course, there are even more marketplaces specializing in pre-owned goods. We've had things like Watchfinder and boutiques in every town trading pre-owned watches for some time now. eBay has been long established, and now we have the likes of Depop for streetwear and higher-end brands becoming increasingly popular. So, Tom, clearly this makes sense from a sustainability perspective, but from a consumer's perspective, what's your take on renting and buying pre-owned rather than buying brand new items?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And I think my take on it is that consumers won't really gravitate towards that as a model for low-ticket items. There's just no need or appetite for them to do so. So I think you've got this dichotomy of high ticket and low ticket sort of items within this area. So if you think about watches and the cost of a luxury watch, we're talking thousands, multiple thousands of pounds. So if I'm looking at a second-hand watch, or I'm looking at selling my watch, then that's something that you do, and that is a clear market. An area that where that's not the case today, but is absolutely coming, and is ripe for disruption, is the car buying industry. Like, why do people need to own a car in this day and age? Where electric cars are increasing, you can imagine a world, and it's got to be coming soon, where every car is just hooked up to a charging point in different locations around cities. If I want to take a trip somewhere, I'll just go, do I want a luxury car? Do I want a basic car? And for that trip, for this day, and I'll walk 20 yards up the road to the latest car that I want to pick up, and I'll get in it, I'll go, and then I'll plug it in wherever I end up. So that's a great example of how much it costs to buy a car, and especially where within the car market at the minute, electric cars are expensive as well. I think that's a good area. So those really high ticket items, and you mentioned fashion. So where will this work for fashion? Well, for designer, expensive clothing in the sort of social era that we live in, where people want to be seen for one-off occasions in really great designer-led clothing. That rental economy will work beautifully in that space. Where it will not work, absolutely will not work, is really in the markets where they have planned obsolescence. And this is bad. I think we've just got to look at it from a regulation perspective, but it's also a case that I think retailers and brands need to also take responsibility for their sort of social responsibility as well. But so fast fashion, I mean, what a great example that you used, is designed to be worn once or twice and then thrown away. I think over half of items end up in landfill from fast fashion. So there's not a sustainable recycling program for that type of clothing yet, because why would there be? If I could buy something for £4 to £10, why am I really going? It's like a pint costs £4 to £10 these days. Just one pint in the pub. Then ultimately, why am I going to hunt round for a secondhand version of that? Why would I rent it? Why would I rent that clothing? I'll buy it and I'll throw it away. And consumers, it's easy for them, and it's easy for them to do that. And this isn't a criticism of them. Why wouldn't they do that? Because it's accessible. They can get what they want. They can wear it. They can look fashionable. And then when the next thing comes along a week later, ultimately it is in the bin. Second bit is consumables, low ticket items. So anything that's obviously consumable is not going to get recycled by a person, i.e. once I've drunk my bottle of Coke, no one's going to go, can I have your empty bottle of Coke to drink, please? But it's all down to packaging, isn't it? It's all down to packaging. So I think there's definitely an element of how we can develop a sustainability program around recycling for the likes of fast fashion. Because you forget, and you don't think about this, you wear clothing and it's made up of plastic. Because you think, well, clothing's like natural and cotton, it's plastic.
Yeah, true.
And as a result of that, yeah, I think when people are throwing away clothes, they don't realize they're throwing away plastic bags, plastic bottles. That is in essence what they're doing. So there's definitely something that needs to help educate consumers around how they should be buying clothing. But then secondly, there's got to be a responsibility for manufacturers to look at a program of recycling and make sure that's working. So, and I won't name any brands, but we all know the fast fashion retailers. How can I bring my clothes back to you so you are reusing those and they're going into my next item? And that's the same for Coca-Cola. They're still using plastic bottles and a hell of a lot of them. But how do they make sure that every single one of their plastic bottles that gets used ends up back in one of their factories or definitely one back in their products so that they're not creating more single-use waste? So I think that high ticket area is an area where I think we'll definitely see growth in the circular economy. In the low ticket area, I'm not sure it's going to change. And I definitely think sustainability is the play that retailers need to be focusing on in that space.
And I tend to agree. And I think that to the latter point, it's a combination of government regulation, social pressure, but then also the responsibility of the business owners and the people running those businesses to make sure that they're acting in a more sustainable way. You know, I think there's definitely some negatives to the fast fashion movement from a sustainability perspective. And for the higher end items, you made a really good point there actually about cars and, you know, moving to more of a rental economy. And it could end up being similar to, you know, when you're in a major city and you can rent a scooter to dart about the city and you can pick it up and leave it in loads of places, convenient locations. You get an app on your phone and you can work out where the inventory is and whether it's charged, so that you can easily, you know, pick up some transport, do your journey, drop it off, that kind of thing. You could definitely see the same happening with vehicles. You know, what vehicle manufacturers would think about that, I'm not quite sure, but you know, that certainly seems to be a good solution to the problem. And then go ahead.
No, I think the other one that you just sparked my thoughts about then is tech. So tech has planned obsolescence. That's twice I've said that now. You can tell I just read it when I was researching this. But Absolutely. Like, my iPhone does not work anymore. Yeah, it's about 4 years old, and it's just like the battery lasts about 3 hours after it plugged in constantly. But I'm getting a bit older now. I'm less bothered about tech. I don't need a new phone. It does everything that I need it to do. The improvement in hardware is so limited in phones nowadays. There's been very little innovation for a long time. It's so little. There has to be a better way. How many batteries, how many phones, how many screens, how many cases are we throwing away? And in that market, there's obviously a big industry of repairs and refurbishing old phones and capability. But why aren't the manufacturers doing that? Well, I know why they're not, because they want consumption and they want you to be buying them. But why can't phones, in a world now where hardware upgrades are limited, focus on software? Why can't they replace components? Why can't you create a phone where if in a year's time the camera's better, I replace the camera in my phone. I don't replace my phone. Why can't we have a market where, remember in PCs in our days, you buy a shell and you put all the bits and components into that shell, yeah? And you'd always compete as to who's got the best motherboard or whatever else went in there. I've never been a PC person, by the way, so don't get me on this. But it was, and it was like, well, what have you got and how have you got it? And then you replace that one component. Phones, for me, is a great example where, why aren't people thinking about buy my phone, buy the shell, and then you can upgrade it and upgrade it and upgrade it by buying components and parts? Or there's more of a software play where you pay for refreshes in software that enhance the phone's capabilities rather than hardware, which is just going nowhere. That's an interesting space, and one I think is also ripe for disruption.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we've talked a little bit about what type of items then lend themselves more to reuse and rental than others. And, you know, you mentioned about kind of special occasion wear. Could be the same for, formal wear. Of course, now very few people wear formal clothes to the office. So maybe if someone had a more formal engagement to go to, like when we were younger, Tom, we probably... you probably, like me, used to rent a tuxedo to go to your university ball and then, you know, handed it back. But you could see people renting smart wear to go to interviews, that kind of thing now. Another question I wanted to ask is there still a stigma attached to renting or buying pre-owned clothing? And is there a behavioural psychology element to this, and something that we need to get over for people to adopt as buyers, for people to be more comfortable with buying secondhand or, you know, owned multiple times or renting items that are owned by someone else?
I definitely think there's a mental block with it for some people, which is, I don't want to wear something that somebody... It's quite a personal thing, isn't it, an item of clothing? Mm-hmm. It's similar with a car in a way, but I think we can get past that really quickly. That if somebody else has worn this, it feels like it's not mine. Mm-hmm. But I definitely think that that's getting smaller. I think people will be really, really willing to look at secondhand clothing let's call it shared clothing, because that's in essence what it is. Mm. And ultimately participate in that. There's a lot of, in younger generations, hunting for bargains, showing that you've got something which is great and value for money. And if you can show that that's just value for money delivered in a different way. So I'm getting something that I could never potentially afford to buy outright, a £500 dress to wear once. But to rent it for £40 or £50 for one occasion and to show myself in that and to be talking about it, I think people will easily get on board with that. And everyone loves a bargain. Again, like talking about human psychology, everyone Absolutely. Will love to talk about how they've got something that's better value than what they think it should be have been charged for. And I think you can play into that. So I think there's a bit of a mix. I'll always say that it's difficult not to talk about yourself in this, but like classic pieces, things that you wear over and over again, probably don't lend themselves as well to this. And your basics also don't. But definitely occasion wear, like you talked about, when we're going back to our university ball and those types of events, certainly higher end products, but rented is a likely sort of area.
Yeah, I think so. And I've seen pros and cons with I've never rented any clothing as such, but certainly bought pre-owned watches. I've bought some pre-owned watches, and you know that's great because it makes, you know, nice watches and other jewelry much, much more accessible than buying them new. It, you know, opens it up to a completely different market, actually. But then I've also bought off places like from places like eBay and Depop, and the trouble that I have with those is the, you know, they don't necessarily have the same level of service as buying new from a retailer. From Depop, for example, you don't have the option to send the product back, and invariably it won't fit. So you're then landed with an item of clothing that you don't want, which you then have to, you know, resell. So I think there are some challenges for companies that specialize in that area, for retailers that specialize in reuse and rental, to be able to offer that kind of customer proposition that we've come to expect from buying new goods. And then from a data and analytics perspective, do you think the same principle apply for retailers who are offering clothing for reuse or items for reuse or rental? Is it the same principles, or actually do they need to focus on some different things that they maybe hadn't considered before?
I think it's mainly the same principles, but the way in which you go about it is different. So you're less in control of the supply chain for reuse. You're, in essence, the model is, how do I best get sell through and margin on the products and items that I've got. So it's slightly different in that aspect, because you're not managing the buy, and you're not managing the buy towards demand. So it's all around matching the product to demand, and probably pricing and adjusting your pricing in the more of the airline model to say, well, we've got lots of this product, not a lot of people that want it. You're going to have to drop your price on that. Versus this is a quite desired item. There are only two of them. People are going to want to pay more money for this. So I think that element and the leveraging data to have that intelligence around understanding demand and understanding people's willingness to pay for an item will be key. And you do that in the same way. So then when is it the same? You do it in the same way that you do for general retail. Put my products together into need states that a customer wants to buy into. Yeah. And once you've done that, you've got your product attributes, you've got your customer needs, and you put those two things together, and then you can map that need within this market to what the price is that you might want to charge for it. So what brand is it? So is it Ralph Lauren? What color is it? Because actually lots of people might want the sort of black, plain Ralph Lauren polo, but nobody wants the bright Larry Green one that you bought on holiday once thinking it was a great idea, and you wore it on one night out. So it's all things like that that really, really matter. So those principles of once you've got the stock are pretty similar. Yeah, make sure you're matching product to need and pricing in a way that's going to sell through, so you don't end up with a ton of warehousing. But it's a bit different, obviously, in that you've got less control over what that stock is in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's true. So I think a closer attention to certain pricing, but also to assortment is going to be key. So is it the same range of products that are going to appeal to someone for rental or for resale, reuse? Or actually, do you need to alter your assortment? And there's some analysis required to get to that type of answer. And then also from a marketing perspective as well, I think you have to be certain about the customers that kind of proposition would appeal to. So I think there's a behavioural piece in there. So it's not all about affluence, I don't think, and affordability, although that certainly plays into it. And some people will be more likely to rent products or buy pre-owned products from an affordability perspective, but also from a psychological perspective as well. And there'll be some people who are totally fine with that. There will be other people where slightly more work is required, and that probably comes down to some of the creative and messaging that's used to persuade people that it's a good option. So I think it does change things from a marketing perspective, from a data and analytics perspective, and it's a new challenge for retailers to think about that they possibly haven't had to engage with so far. And I think it'll be an interesting place and an interesting theme that develops rapidly, I think, over the next couple of years as sustainability comes into ever sharper focus because of what's going on in the world. Okay, we're going to move on to our second topic now, and we're going to talk about what's next for department stores. And the outlook for department stores has looked pretty gloomy for some time now. So Debenhams had been on the ropes for years before they finally closed their remaining 160 stores across the UK in spring 2021, albeit the online brand has survived under new owners Boohoo. John Lewis closed 16 stores during the COVID-19 pandemic, including major cities such as Birmingham and Sheffield, which is, you know, quite a surprise. And clearly footfall was low or non-existent for a time, but even with a promise of people returning to the high street, they still went ahead with those closures. John Lewis has also ditched its never knowingly undersold price match pledge after almost a century, saying it's lost relevance at a time when it faces stiff competition from online retailers such as Amazon, according to The Guardian. They go on to say the staff-owned department store chain said it made the decision to retire the well-known slogan because its price promise did not match online-only retailers and shoppers were increasingly buying online. And then we have Fenix, another famous department store. They've taken the decision to close their landmark New Bond Street store, which is in a prime location in central London, after 130 years. As reported by the BBC in December, Fenix stated that amid the turbulent economic environment, fresh capital investment is required in order to return the business to profitable growth. So, Tom, we both live close to Liverpool, where we have a John Lewis, and Manchester, where we have a John Lewis, a Selfridges, a Harvey Nichols, and no doubt others. Our office is in Leeds, where we've seen the closure of Alders some years ago and Debenhams more recently. So when you physically go shopping, do you typically visit a department store, and what's your view of them?
No, I don't. But I think this is part of the problem for department stores right now. I don't go into the town centre half as much as I used to, mainly through working from home, having children at the weekend, so generally doing stuff there. But being at work, what I generally be is on the high street in the week, and I'm not anymore. And I think that's one major part of their problem. I think the second major part of their problem, and you said this in your introduction, basically increasingly people are buying online. And I think if you want my honest opinion on this, and like what's next for department stores, failure, in my opinion. I think they're a dying format, and I think they've got no chance to survive in the, if they continue in their current guise. So I look at John Lewis, and I think there's a massive amount of transformation required in that business to enable it to survive into a long-term future. My own experience of it, it's too expensive. So that, I mean, they've dropped that price promise. I go in there and I go, oh, this is way overpriced. And I think there's a bit like overpriced, and I feel like they're trying to manage their sales and loss of sales through margin, and that's ultimately going to end in decline because you get more people opting out. The premium doesn't feel enough to pay the price. And I don't feel like they're leveraging or looking to leverage data in a way that can help them get out of that. So I think M&S, who are seeing a bit of a renaissance in the last sort of year or two, and they've come out of COVID looking a lot healthier. And I find M&S interesting. I think we talked on the last podcast, actually, that their proposition from a clothing perspective looks like it's finally improving and doing what it needs to do. So that's helped buoy them a little bit. But also they're looking at innovation, they're looking at data, they've bought Thread, they're looking at ways in which they can leverage data to buy better. They talked about supply chain a lot and the challenges that they had with supply chain. Well, the way out of an inefficient supply chain is to leverage data to understand how much range I need, how much of that range I need, and then when if I'm not selling it, what price do I need to sell it at to make sure I clear through and don't have a warehousing issue. Data. And they look like they're doing something slightly different, but similarly, and they're more reliant on fashion. Where John Lewis are struggling, and this is why I think in their current guise, is for anything which is comparable with a barcode in the retail world. So is it a white good? Is it a TV? Is it a piece of furniture? Is it a brand? If it's comparable, I'm going to check online. And if I can find it cheaper online, I'm going to buy it online. Yeah. And no experience in store is going to stop me doing that, as much as John Lewis would like it to be. So what do I think that the sort of future lies for the likes of John Lewis? Well, they're caught in the middle a little bit. So I think the likes of Selfridges, where they still have a premium reason to go there. It is more about high-end brands, experience, and fashion. It's a bit different. But for the likes of John Lewis, it feels to me like that format has to change entirely. And it has to move to be more towards an entertainment type area. Yeah. So more around reasons to visit, reasons for younger people to go into those stores. So that might be restaurants, food, drinks. Seeing lots of sort of younger generations meeting up for coffees these days, or meet for a coffee in my store. But then why else am I there? What retail entertainment can you give me that engages those types of audiences? And I don't know the answer to this, by the way, but things like innovation around how you try clothes on, going into a room with 10 of your friends and trying clothes on and sharing it on social media, being able to ask for opinions quickly from other people in an environment, getting smarts in there, VR, what people should be doing stuff with VR, definitely. A reason for excitement where you go in and you almost have a fashion experience. I mean, VR needs to improve a little bit more to make it accessible, but that's the sort of thing, to make it an event, a reason to visit. And I think that there's probably going to be a lot of that. It's already happening, but there's definitely, that's kind of my initial thoughts on it.
Yeah, I probably echo a lot of that, although I do go to department stores. And I really like going to department stores, actually. When I go physically shopping, I'm more inclined to go to a department store. I go to John Lewis a lot in Liverpool, than go into a standalone shop, because I think you're less pressured to buy stuff and you can, you know, you can kind of mosey around looking at the different sections. And I think John Lewis in particular has a nice feel to it still, quite a nice premium feel, although not quite to the Selfridges type level. But I also think they've got some fairly clear issues to deal with. So price is one. I agree with you. You know, I'll often look at items. If they're full price, I know I can get them cheaper elsewhere. And being able to get stuff delivered, you know, next day or within a couple of days means that you'll accept not having the immediacy of being able to get the item and wear it that day for, you know, a better price if you wait a day or two. You know, price is a challenge for them. I think having the right amount of sizes is a real issue for them as well. When I go, it seems like, you know, size medium gets absolutely rinsed every time. So it's really difficult to, you know, find the one, you know, the sizes you want. So you can't try it on. So you don't know if you want to buy it. So you don't buy it. You go and, you know, buy it online instead. And I think it's an absolute open goal, really, for VR providers, when that gets up to the right standard, to improve that shopping experience, to be able to try things on, to be able to mimic the size of a garment, if we're talking about clothing specifically, so that the customer can make a decision there and then. I think they've got to improve their kind of trying on facilities as well. You know, it's not particularly pleasant getting into a grubby changing room with stuff all over the floor and surly waiting staff. So I think, you know, that's a clear challenge for physical retailers generally, but yeah, certainly in department stores. And I think if they're going to improve, it's harnessing these new technologies. And I 100% agree with, they've got to turn the department stores into more of an entertainment venue. I mean, they've got big places, you know, these are huge buildings, typically department stores. So why not give over part of those department stores to more entertainment focused things, such as places to eat and drink, you know, maybe, you know, kind of boutique cinemas. You could have, you know, galleries. I think if you could have somewhere for kids to play, that would be a big win for anyone who's got children. You know, you absolutely don't go to shopping full stop, but particularly to department stores, because there's nothing to do with the kids. So, you know, you've got to cater for the kids. And I think there's a whole host of things that a department store could put in place that makes it a great experience, a destination that people look forward to going to. And while they're there, you know, they spend some money on, you know, with the shop. So they probably need to strike partnerships with different, you know, entertainment venues or, you know, food and drink outlets, that kind of thing, to improve that experience. But like you, I fear they're on a, you know, a bit of a death spiral that's going to be extremely hard for them to arrest, to be perfectly honest with you.
Yeah, you brought up two really interesting things there that I'll pick up on. First one, sizing. And it's never been an issue for me. I'm one of these very lucky people that I can generally pick things off the hanger and it will fit. And my wife gets very annoyed at me that that's the case. Whereas she's the opposite. And she says, the reason I go into a shop, Tom, is because nothing will fit me. Nothing will fit me. So if I try and order stuff online, I just send it all back. Definitely. And there's a social element. So humans are social creatures. And whilst I think we can operate in a digital world, and I think social can be in a digital world, there's still smell, there's still touch, there's still the feel of clothing when you put them on. And that's one thing I actually struggle with. ordering things online is the fabric and what I thought I was kind of getting. When you put it on, you go, that looks a bit thin and horrible on me. So department stores and John Lewis specifically, get me in, yeah, measure me, and then recommend to me all of the products and items, even online, yeah? Join it together, click and collect online, whatever it might be. Products that will fit me and fit me well. Materials that I want and I enjoy and I like and I buy. And I know I can't add about all the time, but it comes back to a couple of things. Attributing your products to be able to recommend them. It's what people aren't doing well enough. But the second bit is, why wouldn't you offer that service? And you talked about service being a reason to visit a store. So instead of having a surly person waiting and to let you into the changing rooms, why don't John Lewis especially, it's focused around service, it's a service-led business. Major on that, give a reason for me to go in, offer me something that I can't get anywhere else in terms of that personal styling, sizing, but then this is the important bit, recommendations on the back of it, so it's easy for me to shop. I've got your sizing in all these items, why don't you come and visit? And joining together that experience. It takes me on to another point around gamification, which is talked about a lot these days, but I think gamification is overused as a term. Really, it's engage me with a reason to engage ultimately, but for this is a reason to come into the store. So if we just nailed that model that we've talked about with data, and we've got an app, and we've got, here are your recommendations on your app today. Spin the wheel and get 10% off some of the items that you've, some of the brands or items that are recommended for you. Again, there's a reason to engage there. You kind of go, okay, I'm getting money off if I go in today. There's a reason for me to visit. And I definitely think that a lot of people don't use apps very well, but there's a real opportunity to leverage apps better to give a reason and a reason to engage with a retailer. And I think that people just think that have an app and then therefore that's a great thing. It's got to be part of a loyalty scheme.
Yeah.
That loyalty scheme has got to give you a reason to engage on a regular basis. And the only way it does that is by genuinely giving you something back. So you obviously get that back through rewards in the likes of grocers and coffee shops, where it's obviously after a certain amount of points, you either get pounds off or you get free drinks. But within fashion and sort of department stores, what could that look like? Well, it's got to look like a level of reward, but more around the amount of times I'm in those stores. It might be 2-3 times a year buying high ticket items. Got to be a reason to deliver something for me to come in for that. So I think there's lots of stuff that they could be doing in that space. And then the final bit around entertainment, which you talked about, is I always remember this as a child. And there was a furniture shop, like a sofa shop nearby our house that had a ball pit in it, a ball pit, right? And it was the greatest shop I've ever been in my life, and still to this day is, because I remember it. And I'm pretty sure my parents took me there about once a month. How often are they buying furniture? Not once a month.
Yeah.
We were in that ball pit and we were in that shop. And I'm pretty confident as a result of that ball pit, they bought more furniture from that shop than they've ever bought from anywhere else ever. So I always used to say this when I went to Asda. I'm like, we should just have a ball pit in every store. It's why everyone wants to come in.
Genius.
But what's the modern day equivalent of the ball pit? That's for retailers to answer.
Well, yeah, I don't think you even need a modern day one. I think it's a ball pit in a soft play area for anybody that's got kids up to the age of about 8. And it's an instant win. So, you know, just team up with a soft play sensor and jobs are good. Yeah, and just thinking of other things that department stores might want to consider. There's a really good case study online about a Nike store. I say Nike. I know you say Nike, Tom, but we'll go with Nike. In LA, I believe. And they analyze online shopping behavior of people that live in the catchment of this LA store to determine the assortment that they offer in the store, which is a really smart way to do it. So they don't, it's not kind of finger in the air. It's not the same assortment in every single Nike store across the states. But they specifically look at the profile of people living around that store in LA which is a very distinct profile. I think it's quite an affluent area. It's an athletic area. So they then tailor the assortment that they offer. And I think that's perhaps something that department stores can learn from as well, in terms of the product mix and then the mix within the categories, the product categories that they offer within the store. And then more, probably less analytically and more just common sense is, you know, you go into John Lewis, for example, and there's a big electronics section, electronics and white goods, that kind of thing. And I think that's the kind of thing where people are just, you know, in the main are now comfortable doing their own online research and searching for the cheapest price. So it's almost pointless them having that section. Clothing, you could argue that people want to go in and try stuff on. There's a, you know, there's probably a reason for doing that. And maybe with furniture as well, you'd like to see furniture in a room setting to see if it might suit your home rather than kind of ordering it online and then have the hassle of sending it back because it's such a clunky item. But I think, yeah, that kind of product mix within department stores is something that might help to kind of stave off obsolescence for a bit longer, but an interesting space. Okay, we're going to move on to our final topic of the podcast, and we're going to ask whether it's dark days for Black Friday. So according to The Guardian, Black Friday footfall in the UK was down 20%. It was 20% lower than pre-pandemic levels, 2029, but we saw a small increase when compared to 2021. BBC stated that retail sales volume dropped 0.4% in November 2022, despite Black Friday. And some companies are actively shunning Black Friday, such as IKEA. According to Charged Retail, IKEA did not participate in last year's Black Friday, instead opting to bring its sustainable Green Friday initiative. During Green Friday, IKEA enhanced its buyback and resale scheme where customers can sell furniture back to IKEA. So is Black Friday losing its appeal? Tom, did you buy anything in the Black Friday sales this year?
No.
What? No. Okay. Well, nor did I, but not for want of looking. I had a few bits that I wanted to buy and I looked extensively online for a deal. To your point earlier, people do like a bargain and do like to feel I've got a deal, but I couldn't find it. And I just think that online shopping, despite its growth, is so heavily skewed towards people, the companies that do e-commerce and e-commerce marketing really, really well. To the point where you often can't find the stuff you want because it's, you know, hidden way below people that optimize their digital marketing and get to the top of the queue. But I, you know, I definitely would have bought stuff if I could find it. And do you look out for it on the calendar, Black Friday and Cyber Monday and all that?
Only because I work in retail and it's a key moment for us as a business and clients that we work with. I think my perception of it is that it worked, and it probably still works in the US, where you have a physical retail market. So the home shopping market in the US is much more disparate. It's much more difficult because of the size of the country. And you've got a lot of physical stores. So where Black Friday was interesting and exciting is where you had massive, deep discounts on genuine deals. But this is the important thing. What you're able to do is drive people into store where you don't have deep discounts and you've got margin accretive lines that offset that. And for retailers in that way, in the physical space, it can work. I think what retailers have been finding in the digital space, and certainly in this country, yes, you get a boost in sales over a short period of time that you've given away a bit of margin on. But what's actually happened is you just pulled forward demand from Christmas, because ultimately I'm now not increasing or topping up on that. I've bought what I needed to buy, and you don't have that margin accretive lines that are added in with it because it's in the digital space and it's much harder to get the cross sell upsell type things going on in the digital arena. Now people could try and do things differently, so get access to certain deals if you buy other products, but no one has done that from what I've seen. And maybe could do a better job of recommending other items that could complement some of the deep discount lines. So majoring on some real great deals, but then trying to bundle them or sort of offer other items that people might be interested in that aren't hitting margins quite so badly. And certainly as a consumer, and from my perspective, I've lost trust in all of the deals now. I feel like I don't see genuine offers, deals, value, which is, so when you asked me the question, I said, no, let me give you my cynical. I've got a lot of cynical view on life, to be honest with you. But I now go, I just don't believe their deals anymore. So I'm kind of bothered to look. And I know a lot of people share that opinion with me. And so I think retail and retailers have lost trust a little bit, because initially it was deals on genuine products. Now it's been manipulated to put product into the market, which isn't really a great deal. And so for the retailers that are still doing it, yeah, they're getting the bad reputation for the ones that haven't and have inflated prices to then drop them for Black Friday to make it feel like a deal when it's not. And so I think there's a bit of a consumer loss of trust. I think, to your point, it's hard to find deals in the digital space. And where it really worked is obviously in physical, and where you've genuinely got deals on great products that everyone would look at and go, wow, get myself there. And I don't see that here anymore. After the sort of 2 or 3 years of initial Black Friday excitement, I don't genuinely see that anymore. So that's why it's not necessarily working. And I think more people will pull away from it, because probably what's happening in retail is just hitting margins, and who wants that? What retailers should be doing is thinking more around leveraging their data to do all the things that we've done before, which is maximize your margins on your whole range, not just a few lines for an exciting event. And make sure you're looking at when you can put prices up, because you are selling through stock at a higher rate. You've got products that are in demand. Having a more real-time view of your supply chain and the demand against that supply chain, which enables you to make the margin and protect your margin on lines that are in high demand that you have low stock on. And then if you need to start clearing through stock, and you have got too much of certain products, put them on really big deals. Yeah, so we've got way too much warehouse space taken up by certain products that you're not clearing through. Deep discounts, really big deep discounts, clear that through. But you've balanced it with the margin of the lines that you want to protect it on. That's what they should be doing, and they should be using data for that.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree with that. I think there is a major loss of trust, and you're seeing kind of, you know, slight discounts that are not enough really to encourage people to buy. And a good point as well about whether it could drive footfall in stores, and then the retailers could sell higher margin products while the customer's in there. I think the problem with any, it's like the Christmas sales, isn't it? You know, I don't think I've been into any kind of Christmas, post-Christmas sales in a physical retailer for years, because it's just an absolute scrum. Like, you're left with the last few items, the last few sizes, you know, clothes are strewn everywhere, stressed out shoppers. It's a really horrible shopping experience. And I think, Black Friday is the same in a physical retail environment. So I think that kind of prevents people from going in. So it's kind of, you know, counteracts the benefit that a retailer might see. So I think it's, Black Friday will probably decline in popularity unless something radical happens. But I think we'll probably go along on the same trend over the next few years, and gradually it'll lose its appeal. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. Okay, good stuff. So we're going to wrap it up there. That brings us to the end of another podcast. And we've talked about three more key topics. We've talked about the circular economy, the rise of the circular economy. We've talked about what's next for department stores and dark days for Black Friday. And I think we've concluded that the circular economy is on the up and up, and department stores and Black Friday are on the down. I think that's my conclusion from the episode. So if you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe via your favorite podcast platform, tell a colleague, or send us your feedback to peterdenby@hyperfinity.ai, or do all three. And I want to say thanks to my guest, Tom Hill.
No problem, Peter. I've not pressed mute today, so thanks for having
good.
Me.
Less editing for me afterwards. thanks, Tom, and we'll see you all next time.